Good morning. This is a podcast runs through it, which in these times, being the COVID-19 times, we're coming to you from Livingston in part, but we're all coming from our various homes. Hi, Dixie.
Hello, Nelson.
I'm also here. I'm up in the wine glass and you're downtown or down in Livingston itself. So we're doing what people are doing, which is being socially separated, but contributing to joint projects like this podcast. So today's April 30th, Thursday, April 30th, I think. It's hard to keep track of the days, I think. But we are now, 5 days into the reopening of Montana. And people are, I think, watching and waiting to see what happens in the next week or so. Do our numbers go up or down or what happens? At the moment, we look pretty good. But Montana, let's see. Well, what do you think about it, Dixie?
Well, I think one thing that I'm still really concerned about is the lack of testing and the availability of testing. I still think that if you asked anybody on the COVID task force or even Governor Bullock himself how many cases there are in Montana, I don't think you could actually get an accurate answer to that question.
Yeah, so it leaves the same dilemma for people that are thinking about going out and participating or doing something, that you don't know how many people out there have been tested. Most of them haven't. And this particular virus is notorious because of its incredibly long latency period from 5 days to 14 days, and you can be infectious in that period.
Exactly. And then and the people that are anti symptomatic, you know, I think that creates a whole other set of problems, you know, and particularly when you start talking about opening schools, it's just really discomforting, I think.
Yes, and there are plenty of cases where they have opened schools and then immediately shut them down because cases start popping up. And that's right. Happening. And the United States is not the only place, of course, that's dealing with this reopening issue. It's, you know, everywhere we go, everywhere everybody we talk to has some of the same questions and same problems. And as you said, unless we test and we have some idea of the spread and the concentration of who's sick now and that kind of thing, we're still flying blind.
Right, right. And you know, and it's not like there isn't already some, protocols for reopening. You know, you look at countries like Taiwan, where they've been able to deal with this, but they also have an incredibly well-organized testing system and a tracking system, which there's a total absence of that, you know, in the U.S. I think just the incompetency of our response has really left us in a vulnerable situation.
Yeah, and it's the confusion that's been caused by the incompetence. They don't want testing, I think, and they don't talk about it, so people are pretty much unaware of the fact that there are two kinds of tests, and they have to be done in a different order, and they get different kinds of information out of them, and what we need is the confirmation we can go back to work or we can go shopping and not have to worry that, 60% of the people we're looking at are also infected and might infect us. We don't know that.
Right. Right. Yeah. So we still have a ways to go. And I think we could really learn a lot by just looking at, what other countries are doing and the successes. And also, but I think a big part of it too, is we need to be willing to admit to our failures in this country. And at least from the top, from the administration, that is absolutely not happening.
No, I think people, regardless of what you think ideologically, the happy talk coming from Washington, from the White House particularly, is not confidence inspiring.
Not at all.
So, well, that having been said about where we're at right now and everybody's going through this at the same time, today we're going to be doing an interview with Alex Raitt, who is the legal director of the American Civil Liberties Union in Montana, ACLU Montana. And they have, for example, and we'll talk to him about this, one particularly active COVID-related case right now, as having to do with releasing prisoners. But the ACLU has a long history of dealing with questions that nobody else really wants to deal with. Sometimes they're politically hot potatoes. Sometimes they're just strange. And we'll cover a couple of those today. But I want to emphasize that the ACLU here in Montana, as well as national, has a long history and been doing this for many decades and have done tens of thousands of cases. And as people have pointed out, if you really knew what they've been doing and all the cases they've won, we would actually have a different country and a different life if they didn't exist.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah, and a lot of basic rights that we see, especially with minorities and people that are financially disadvantaged, shall we say, a lot of the rights that those people have is because the ACLU has been working on this, like you said, for a long time. And, I think it's really a good thing for us to spotlight the work that they're doing now. But also, I would encourage people to go back and look at the history of the ACLU and, all of the hard work that they have been doing for decades, like you said.
Well, with that having been said, let's move on to the interview. Good morning. This is A Podcast Runs Through It. And as promised, today we're interviewing Alex Raitt, who is the legal director for Montana ACLU, which is American Civil Liberties Union, for those of you who haven't heard that acronym 400,000 times. Alex, good morning.
Good morning. Happy to be here.
And I think you're in Livingston, is that correct?
I sure am. My office is here in Livingston. ACLU of Montana's primary office location is in Missoula, so I travel back and forth between Missoula and Livingston on a regular basis.
Well, in the summer, that's a nice trip.
Yeah, needless to say, I'm pretty grateful when June rolls around and I'm not fishtailing my way between Livingston and Missoula.
Oh, well, I appreciate that under the circumstances, travel is difficult, and that'll be one of the main areas of discussion, of course, is what is the COVID-19, coronavirus crisis, doing to the ACLU? I know you have at least one case involving that. So this morning I thought we'd start out by maybe talking about the coronavirus case, if you want to call it that, that has to deal with Montana prisons and the incarcerated population in the prisons. And I'll let you explain, but we would like to get at two things here. One, a little bit of background about the ACLU and yourself, and also how you come upon choosing your great cases. You know, you must get many of them. I'm sure you have to do some kind of filtering or decision pattern that puts together which cases you're going to take. So anyway, quite a bit to talk about, and let's get started here.
Great.
Is it involving a particular prison or just the prison system in general and the necessity of releasing prisoners in order to try to basically save their lives? But
yeah, so as you might imagine, the coronavirus pandemic has changed the look and feel of the work that ACLU of Montana and actually all of the ACLU affiliates across the country of what they're doing. And so we have been gravely concerned about vulnerable populations, individuals who are over the age of 65 or who have pre-existing conditions, and in particular, those people who are at risk of contracting the virus within correctional settings. So we know from New York and from Louisiana that once the virus appears in a jail or prison, it's going to spread like wildfire, and that those individuals are unable to socially distance. They have inadequate access to hygiene, necessary hygiene and protective equipment. They have difficulty going to the hospital in the event that their symptoms become complicated. And so we've been very concerned from the get-go that these places would become breeding grounds for the virus, and not just for those individuals who are incarcerated, but also for those individuals who are working in correctional settings, so corrections officers, administrative staff, et cetera. And in particular, we saw in the Rikers Island prison in New York, the Oakdale prison in Louisiana, that these places, these correctional facilities, can indeed become a real breeding ground for the virus. And once it hits, there's really not much you can do. So we crafted a strategy that we hoped would prevent the outbreak in correctional settings across the state. And when I say correctional settings, I'm not just talking about those facilities that are operated by Department of Corrections, which would be primarily the Montana State Prison, which houses male prisoners, and then the Montana Women's Prison in Yellowstone County. But we also wanted to focus on county detention facilities, many of which are overpopulated and have been historically. And from our perspective, and what we heard from the public health experts, was that the only real way to address the crisis before it becomes a pandemic in the correctional settings is to immediately and rapidly decarcerate the population in these facilities. So that was what the petition that we filed with the Montana Supreme Court was intended to do, was to take a broad look at all of the facilities across the state and see what measures could be undertaken in order to ensure that people working in those facilities and people living in those facilities had the ability to socially distance, had the access to protective equipment and hygiene and medical treatment if necessary.
If I can ask, how did you decide, or why did it go directly to the Supreme Court? I think I can figure out the answer, but.
Yeah, well, there isn't much of a legal mechanism for getting at broad-based relief other than filing at the Montana Supreme Court. So, for example, if we had heard that there was a particular problem at Yellowstone County, or we could have brought a case on behalf of a particular prisoner or a group of prisoners, just getting at the conditions that exist there. But from our perspective, this was a much broader problem that really necessitated a holistic approach to the solution. So that was one of the reasons why we approached the Montana Supreme Court with our petition. The second reason is that the Montana Supreme Court really deserves to be complimented for the proactive steps that it undertook in the form of issuing guidance to district courts, guidance to courts of limited jurisdiction, suggesting that they undertake an aggressive review of their jail rosters and start releasing those nonviolent offenders as soon as possible in order to protect those that remained on the inside.
Now, in this petition, do you have a so-and-so versus so-and-so, or is it more generalized?
Well, the petition was filed on behalf of Disability Rights Montana. We represented DRM, which is an organization dedicated to protecting and uplifting the rights of disabled Montanans. And in particular, our concern was that disabled Montanans and people with disabilities who are in correctional facilities are often at the highest risk of any number of medical issues, including the COVID-19 pandemic. So the case was brought on behalf of DRM, and listed as respondents were all of the judicial districts across the state, the courts of limited jurisdiction, and the Montana Department of Corrections and Board of Pardons and Parole.
Okay, so for example, this wasn't versus Bullock, Governor Bullock.
It wasn't against Governor Bullock per se. And, the governor had issued guidance to correctional facilities shortly after we filed our petition, which we didn't feel like went far enough in terms of mandating the release of particular prisoners. But really, the entities at the state level who are responsible for reviewing rosters and decarcerating would be the Montana Department of Corrections and the Montana Board of Pardons and Parole.
Okay, so when I have no idea what your caseload could be, but I'm assuming that it could be very heavy. When you get a number of cases, or you look at this, well, as you explained, this is a statewide issue that you're taking that way, but it could have been a local issue if you'd decided to go that way. How do you look at your, well, what is your mechanism for deciding how, which cases you take and listen to and all that?
Yeah, good question. So I think it's fair to say that ACLU of Montana is the only organization that's in a position to protect civil liberties across the board. So everything from immigrant rights to criminalization of poverty and jail issues to abortion access to First Amendment free speech issues, environmental justice, indigenous justice, all of those issues are on our waterfront and on our plate to address. So we've, it oftentimes this job feels like you're drinking from the fire hose, and it's very difficult to figure out where we get are going to get the most bang for our buck. So that being said, I mean, it's important to me as the legal director to make sure that we have active cases in as many categories of civil rights and civil liberties issues as possible. And when I'm trying to pick out a case, we want to have the greatest impact on the largest number of people who may be marginalized by a particular state law or state initiative. So, you know, if we're talking about voting rights, it's much preferable to be working to address systemic issues in the voting system rather than to address the issue on behalf of one individual. Which isn't to say that we don't periodically take cases on behalf of one individual, but typically we want to represent an individual in a case that would have broad systemic impact. So for example, we represent a transgender attorney in a case challenging Yellowstone County's health benefits plan, which we hope will establish statewide protections for individuals who are transgender or non-binary.
Okay, so to put it in kind of, I guess, fairly blunt terms, you also must look at each case for who do you have, which among your lawyers, and maybe you could explain how you get your pool of lawyers, but and your resources at hand besides, you know, it costs money to do cases, even if your lawyers are working pro bono, and I'm not even sure how that works for you, but could you explain a little bit about that aspect of putting together a case, and I'm sure that goes into your decision as well.
Yeah, so we are operating on an extremely tight budget. So, for example, right now our legal department consists of myself, a legal fellow, and then our paralegal. And we are very much generalists. So I came to this position as a litigator. I look at myself as a jack of all trades and master of none. And the good news is that we have the benefit of relying upon folks in our national office who are very much experts in a particular civil liberties field. So on some of our immigration cases, we've partnered with our National Immigrant Rights Project. On our Keystone case, for example, we worked with our Speech, Privacy, and Technology Project. So we have the benefit of a deep stable of committed and brilliant attorneys out of our national office that can support us on any particular case. We also have the good fortune of working with outstanding private attorneys. So for example, on the COVID-19 petition, I had the good fortune of working with a really masterful appellate lawyer out of Bozeman. And on most of the cases that we file, we do have cooperating attorneys who can help not just with sort of the resources the case requires, but also sort of the heavy lifting when it comes to taking depositions, reviewing discovery, et cetera.
Okay. Just briefly touching on, I think people need to understand that the ACLU is a nonprofit organization. Is that correct?
Yes, we are. We're a nonprofit 501c3. We do have a policy and advocacy shop that does some C4 lobbying activity during the legislative session, but our funds are definitely not unlimited, and we have to make the most of the resources that we have. Mm-hmm.
And have you noticed any change in donation or support during this COVID period, or is it too early to tell?
I think it's probably too early to tell. I mean, I think that And this goes for any nonprofit. I mean, many nonprofits are concerned about what the long-term impact of the pandemic will be on the economy, on philanthropic giving. But, you know, we definitely saw a massive mobilization of people who are interested in protecting civil rights and civil liberties after the 2016 election of President Trump. And I don't feel like that sort of fervor has gone anywhere.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's going to be a universal condition for nonprofits. But I just wanted to sort of emphasize that you, like many organizations, you depend on donations and
yeah.
memberships as well.
Yeah, absolutely. And to your listeners, if you're interested in learning more about the ACLU or supporting the work that we do, I encourage you to go to aclumontana.org. And we've got all sorts of resources available for folks who want to get involved.
Well, anyway, let's go back to the COVID case, and maybe you can talk a little bit about the process of, okay, all we're going to do the COVID case. What does that mean? What do you do before you actually present the case? What things like scheduling? I know you have to work with a judicial schedule, whatever it is, whatever level of court. Explain a little bit about that.
Yeah, well, like I noted earlier, I mean, we knew that this case was a long shot. I mean, it's a rare case where the Montana Supreme Court accepts jurisdiction, original jurisdiction, over a matter that hasn't percolated up to the lower courts. So we knew that we were fighting an uphill battle. But we also knew that other states had brought similar petitions that had been successful. And so we wanted to model our effort on some of those successful endeavors that had occurred in Massachusetts and Hawaii. And so we had some resources at our disposal and some templates to lean on. But essentially, you know, we felt like, as I noted earlier, the ball game was before the Montana Supreme Court, and we knew that we sort of had one bite at the apple. So we sort of set all of our other urgent work to the side and spent a very hectic week or so drafting the petition and filed it, not knowing what the court would do. And also knowing that what we were asking the court to do was order extraordinary relief. And the court very quickly turned around and ordered that all of the respondents in the case file a response brief, which was a really positive step. And we filed our final reply brief shortly thereafter. And what we were seeking was a couple of things. So one, we just wanted the opportunity to develop a factual record to talk about what was going on the ground in some of the county jails and at the state facilities. And then, and in order to do that, we asked for additional briefing from the Montana Supreme Court. And what we also would have liked to see was the appointment of a special master, which is essentially somebody or some group of people that the court selects to undertake an orderly review of how facilities across the state could decarcerate. And when I say decarcerate, essentially I mean it. I'm saying reduce the prison and jail population. And you know, we felt like there are categories of pretrial detainees, for example, who can't post bond, who could have been safely released. We felt like there were categories of nonviolent offenders who could be temporarily released, categories of individuals who were coming up on parole or medically eligible for parole who could have been released. So there are broad categories of folks that we felt like could have been released from jails and prisons without posing any danger to society, and that would have permitted these facilities to rapidly reduce their jail and prison population. And the good news is that a number of jurisdictions across the state, shout out to Flathead County, shout out to Cascade County, actually were doing that already. But we just didn't know the extent to which this was a uniform response across the state. And we have access to some population numbers for jails, for example, in Butte Silverbow or Lewis and Clark County that have historically and remain overcrowded. So shortly after the reply brief was filed, the court issued an order denying our petition. So unfortunately, that was the end of the road as it related to our sort of statewide efforts to decarcerate. And I think that that order sort of mirrored where we were on the curve in a larger sense in Montana. So we had just received the first glimmers of good news that the curve had been flattened, that there was, the possibility that some restrictions might be lifted. And so what the court said in its order is essentially, you know, between Governor Bullock's order, between the Montana Supreme Court's directive, between the individual efforts that some jurisdictions are undertaking, the state of Montana is doing what it's required under the law in order to protect prisoners from the spread of the virus.
Okay, so in other words, well, I think these are kind of unusual cases. They're obviously, going right to the Supreme Court is unusual. The time limitation, the changing ground, the environment around it is, you know, makes it difficult. But I would guess these are not typical cases for you in any means.
Yeah, this is this was a first in my legal career. So to say it's unusual would probably be an understatement. And as I noted, I mean, we knew from the get-go that this was going to be a real long shot. But we felt like we had an obligation to those people who are vulnerable, not to stay on the sidelines. And so we gave it a shot. We came up short. But I feel like we've started a conversation, or at least fostered a conversation among, courts of limited jurisdiction, district courts, and elsewhere about what measures should be undertaken under these emergency circumstances. Mm-hmm. So I can't emphasize it enough that these are very unique times. And this was a very unique lawsuit. It doesn't mirror anything that we've done in other categories of civil rights and civil liberties. But again, we felt morally obligated to do what we could to help out the incarcerated population.
So basically it sounds like you've established some kind of a framework for, you know, future situations where there are, you know, pandemics or contagious diseases. Do you sort of feel like you've been able to accomplish that?
Yeah, I mean, I think that that's one silver lining. I think that, a lot of people are thinking about what happens next and when the next wave might come or when the next virus might come through. And so I do think that, you know, there is now precedent and there's now, as you noted, a framework for getting out ahead of these issues.
Right.
And in Montana, we've been very fortunate to have to, you know, geographically and otherwise, sort of see how the virus spread in other states and have the benefit of a few weeks to get out ahead of it. And many state agencies, county agencies, local governments have taken extremely progressive, proactive measures based on what they've seen happening in other states. We remain concerned that, you know, even under the current circumstances, much less what might happen if there's a second spike, what will happen in correctional settings. Mm-hmm.
Right.
Well, this one, maybe a little less than quite a few, is not as controversial, although in some parts of the country, the release of prisoners has been made a political issue. Now, I know ACLU is no stranger to controversy and political issues, which gives me a segue to another area of which I know you're very active in, and that is in the Keystone XL pipeline. I believe ACLU has, or you do, have more than one case going there. Is that correct?
Yeah, so we've had a number of public records cases related to the Keystone pipeline. And there are numerous other organizations that are very capably litigating the environmental issues associated with the pipeline. As an organization, we oppose the pipeline. We want to do everything that we can to support tribal communities that will be negatively impacted by the pipeline. But our legal effort has really revolved around the potential protests that will arise once pipeline construction begins in earnest. So along the lines of what you saw in Standing Rock, for construction of the Dakota Access Pipeline. So we, what we wanted to do was start to get an early understanding of how state, local, and federal governments were preparing to handle protesters. And so we filed a federal FOIA case against the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers, the Department of Defense, and others seeking information about what those preparations look like. They refused to provide us with the information that we requested, and so we had to file a lawsuit that was ultimately successful in obtaining a number of records, records that demonstrated that, in fact, the federal government is working hand-in-hand with state and local government. Things like the BLM ordering riot batons and riot gear. You know, I think typically we tend to think of our BLM agents as friendly people wearing brown vests, you know, helping out the public. But it's a bit of a frightening scenario to imagine those same people wearing helmets and carrying riot batons. And
so then, that's what you found? That's what they actually have done?
Yes. So we obtained documents demonstrating that indeed they are very concerned about protests, and they are considering water protectors and protesters to be akin to terrorists. And I think that that's a theme that we see in all of the documents that have been produced from state, local, and county agencies. We also received things like a document from Montana Fish, Wildlife, and Parks, of all agencies, that said, you know, while we are concerned about legitimate law enforcement necessities around man camps, and man camps are those places that are built up to house pipeline construction workers and which historically have been hotbeds of drug trafficking and sex trafficking and a real plague on tribal communities. So Fish, Wildlife, and Parks said they understand that there's legitimate law enforcement needs around man camps, but they said, but our priority is going to be on policing protesters. So, yeah, I mean, we're very concerned about this sort of larger ether of over-policing along the lines of what we saw with Standing Rock. And so we now have a tandem case in state court seeking the release of certain documents that the Montana Division of Criminal Investigation and Disaster and Emergency Services have withheld from public viewing.
Wow.
And so goes these, I'm sure that this kind of thing is one of the main reasons the ACLU exists, because you can pursue issues, you know, and I want to stress that this is the kind of thing that's not cut and dried. You start at one point and you may wind up at other points. In this case, more cases.
Yeah, that's true. And it's also true that protecting the right to free speech, the right to freedom of association, those rights contained in the First Amendment has historically been one of the real pillars of ACLU's mission. And so, you know, for those individuals who, you know, whether they're water protectors or environmental protesters who intend to exercise their legitimate First Amendment rights to protest the construction of a destructive pipeline, they need to know what to expect from in terms of a government response. And so that was very much what we wanted to do, was to arm these protesters or prepare these protesters for what they might expect in the form of, you know, is it dogs? Is it rubber bullets? Is it water cannons? And so, you know, is it private security? Is it monitoring social media? So that was the thrust of our public records request to the federal government and the state government.
Yeah, I think Dixie and I are both going, we knew some of this, of course, but when you dig into what's actually going on some of these circumstances, you go, didn't know that.
Yeah, it's kind of shocking.
I would guess that among the cases you have, this is maybe one of the more controversial.
I don't know that it's controversial. I mean, from a legal perspective, it's very cut and dry under our constitutional right to know and our right to know statute. So I wouldn't say that it's as complicated as some of our other cases. But certainly, you know, there is a large effort underway on the other side in collaboration between the federal government, the state government, private contractors, and TC Energy to make sure that the greases or the skids are greased for construction of the pipeline. And I can't, you know, in good conscience proceed without, again, just shouting out those organizations like the Native American Rights Fund, like the Sierra Club, that are on the front lines of actually trying to prevent the pipeline from being constructed.
Mm-hmm. So the ACLU's position in this particular instance is a free speech and oriented toward constitutional rights more than maybe some of the more technical parts of it.
Exactly.
Let's move on to I know you have a long list of cases. I'm not sure which ones are actually still active, but Indigenous voter rights would certainly be in what's happening now and the upcoming primary and then eventually the general election. Could you explain a little bit about that particular case?
Sure. So this was a recent case that we filed. To back up a little bit, back in 2016 or 2018, the voters passed what's called the Ballot Interference Protection Act. And what the Ballot Interference Protection Act does is it prevents an individual from collecting ballots from another individual and delivering them to a polling place. So historically, organizations like Western Native Voice, Montana Native Vote, League of Conservation Voters, Montana Women Vote, these organizations employ organizers who are out in the field collecting ballots. And what the law was intended to do was to disenfranchise those people who have particular barriers to voting access. And in particular, the folks and the segments of society that have the most barriers to access are Indigenous voters on rural reservations, who may not have reliable access to the post office, who may have to travel great distances in order to cast their vote, and who, you know, may have issues related to poverty that prevent their ability to access the ballot box. So we filed a constitutional challenge against the Ballot Interference Protection Act, requesting that a court enjoin or stop the law from being implemented for the 2020 elections, both the primary and the general. We're in the process of briefing that as we speak, and we hope that the evidence that we've presented, which goes to these barriers that exist, will be sufficient to persuade the judge that the law should be enjoined. Because really, the law is specifically designed to disenfranchise voters. There has not been any evidence of voter fraud related to ballot collection. There are existing protections under the statutes governing voting to prevent voter fraud. So the Ballot Interference Protection Act was very much a solution in search of a problem.
I chuckle, but it's not funny. Well, how do you see that case evolving now, between now and, let's say, the primary?
Yeah, so, I mean, we know that ballots are going to be printed imminently, and we're asking for the court to act expeditiously on our motion for preliminary injunction. We need to have a hearing, and then we hope that in short order thereafter the court will rule. Of course, the state is very aggressively defending the case, as we expected them to. There is a tandem case that was filed by the Montana Democratic Party, also seeking to enjoin the law. We welcome their participation, but from our perspective, this is absolutely not a partisan issue. This is about disenfranchising rural voters, and in particular, Indigenous voters living on rural reservations.
So, you in this case, you're basically defending the mail-in ballot, right?
So yes, I mean, I think that it's fair to say that it's very important that mail-in voting or vote by mail should be as widely available as is humanly possible. But we also want to make sure that there's still the option for some in-person voting for those people, again, don't have reliable access to post office boxes or mail delivery. So under settlement from back in 2000, I'm forgetting which year, the Wandering Medicine case, some tribes across the state are entitled to have what's called a satellite voting location established on the reservation, which permit people to vote in person. And so we feel like that's still a really important tool to be available to voters on reservations across the state. But yes, I mean, I think that at the end of the day, to the extent that we can make vote by mail as easy, free of charge, and universally applicable, all voters in Montana are going to benefit.
Yeah, that's it's interesting because I know various states have many, there are a lot of issues associated with voter suppression and the mail-in ballot issues and that sort of thing. So this, I would say, would be your Montana version of that, right?
Indeed. And, you know, you see these efforts undertaken, as you noted, Nelson, across the country, and you periodically see them pop up here in Montana as well. Just a blatant attempt to disenfranchise certain segments of the voting public.
Mm-hmm. Okay. What I'm doing is kind of going through some of your issues. I really wanted people to understand that the ACLU does a extremely wide variety of issues, and they don't follow any particular partisan or party pattern. You know, you're mostly interested in defending people who have had difficulty defending themselves, right? It's one of the purposes of the ACLU, I think. You can speak to that.
Yeah, I think that's fair to say. And again, I mean, we are a bulwark to protect those folks who are marginalized in our system. So whether that's individuals who are incarcerated, whether that's LGBTQ folks, whether that's Indigenous folks, Latinx, or immigrant folks, it's definitely across the board.
Yeah, I would like to refer to one particular case because I think maybe people haven't heard of it, and it also kind of, I think, exemplifies some of the stranger things that ACL has had to deal with, and that is the Border Patrol detaining people who speak Spanish.
Yes. So we are working on a case on behalf of Ana Suda and Martha Hernandez, two amazingly strong individuals of Latinx descent who live up in Havre. They were out shopping at the town pump at night back in 2018 when, unbeknownst to them, an agent for the U.S. Customs and Border Protection entered the store behind them. He heard them speaking Spanish to one another, but bears noting that both Ana and Mimi are U.S. citizens, and he demanded to see their IDs. They were then escorted out to his Customs and Border Protection vehicle, where he immediately started doing a search to find out their status, their citizenship status. In the meantime, to Ana and Mimi's credit, they began videoing the encounter, and they asked the agent point blank, "Why are you stopping us?" And his response could not have been clearer and more frightening. He said, "Well, I'm stopping you because you're speaking Spanish, and you don't hear people speaking Spanish all that much in these parts."
Oh, geez.
The addendum to that is that the agent supervisor showed up shortly thereafter, and Ana and Mimi asked the supervisor, they said, "Well, here we are, you know, just a few miles from the Canadian border where there are plenty of French speakers." And they said, "Would you have stopped us if we were speaking French?" And the CBP supervisor's response was, "No, of course we wouldn't do that." So we filed a case against the U.S. Customs and Border Protection that's currently pending, seeking some damages on behalf of Ana and Mimi for what we believe to be an illegal arrest or an illegal stop. but also seeking a declaration from the court that Customs and Border Protection agents cannot use Spanish as a proxy or as a reason to give them probable cause or reasonable suspicion to stop somebody. So just because you're out speaking Spanish in public does not entitle the Customs and Border Protection to pull you aside and demand your papers. So that's an important case, just in terms of pushing back on the institutional creep that we're seeing from federal immigration authorities, both from Immigration and Customs Enforcement, which is ICE, and U.S. Customs and Border Protection.
Yeah, I can imagine that. Are there other cases like that in the United States that you know of, or is this a unique case that happened to prop up here?
Well, it's somewhat unique under these current circumstances. I mean, definitely you see this type of profiling happening every day on the southern border. And one of the reasons why this case has developed so much attention or generated so much attention is that it's on the northern border. But the Montana Latinx population is growing by the day. And so there is a real misnomer out there that we are not a diverse state. And so I think that this is an important case to remind people that it is not against the law to speak other languages, and that we need to have welcoming communities for Latinx folks, whether they're immigrants or whether they're U.S. citizens.
Yep, makes sense. Another, I don't think, this is a difficult, I'm sure these are difficult cases, but the one that's received quite a bit of attention is the LGBTQ discrimination case, particularly transgender. I of all the areas you probably get into, this one, I don't know, maybe it's not, but it would be politically charged anyway, and a difficult environment to work in. Maybe you can explain a little bit about the cases you have pending there.
Yeah, for sure. So, yes, you're correct that the LGBTQ community has been targeted repeatedly by organizations like the Montana Family Foundation for years. And despite the progress that we've seen, both in the courts and the court of public opinion, there are still significant challenges. So the Montana Human Rights Act, which is our statute that protects against discrimination on the basis of race, on the basis of disability, on the basis of sex, has never been interpreted explicitly by a court in Montana to protect folks who may be trans or non-binary. And so we brought a case on behalf of a transgender attorney out of Yellowstone County who sought coverage under the county's healthcare plan for gender-affirming care. And the coverage was denied because there is an explicit exclusion in the healthcare plan for such gender-affirming care. And we believe that that is facially discriminatory on the basis of an individual's gender identity. So we actually have a trial scheduled for July to determine just that the Montana Human Rights Act prohibits discrimination on the basis of sex, which includes an individual's gender identity. And your listeners might know that there are some similar cases that are pending before the U.S. Supreme Court. But what we've argued is that, and one of the benefits of practicing in Montana is that we have a really beautiful constitution that was adopted in 1972. And our constitution has specific protections for the right to privacy, and interestingly, the right to individual dignity. And so regardless of what the federal law is as it relates to protections for LGBTQ folks, under Montana law, we believe that there is a very strong case to be made that there are additional protections for any number of marginalized groups, first and foremost, the LGBTQ community.
Well, I think right now we've covered about five issues or five cases, well, some more cases than that, but fairly representative group. At this point, are there any other cases or issues that you'd like to highlight that we haven't covered so far? Just to illustrate sure. the breadth of ACLU's activity.
Yeah, I can just briefly touch on a few other categories. So we have active case against the Montana State Prison related to the placement of individuals who have significant mental health problems in solitary confinement. That's been a case that's been ongoing for 5 years now, and is very complicated, but we believe that the Eighth Amendment to the U.S. Constitution, which prohibits against cruel and unusual punishment, means that an individual should not be locked in solitary confinement simply because they are exhibiting manifestations of a mental health issue. We have a case involving increasing access to reproductive health care. So this is a case on behalf of an advanced practice registered nurse who is completely qualified to perform abortion services. And we believe under Montana's right to privacy, it should be made clear that somebody seeking an abortion or reproductive health care should have the opportunity of selecting the healthcare professional of their choice, provided that person is qualified, and advanced practice clinicians definitely fit that category. We have a case that's challenging the lethal injection statute in Montana, which resulted in an injunction against administration of the lethal injection drug cocktail. And that case is still pending as well. We have a case that we just won on behalf of individuals who are held on what are called immigration detainers. The Montana Supreme Court just a month ago ruled that immigration detainers are unlawful. And then I guess the last case I would mention is a case against the cash bail industry. They had a number, there were some bounty hunters who broke into our client's house while they were in bed with their six-year-old daughter. The bounty hunters were armed with body armor and assault rifles, and they were attempting to collect on a $115 bond that our client owed. And we believe that such actions by bounty hunters, by bail bondsmen, by the insurance industry that underwrites those agents is unlawful and unconstitutional. And so we have brought a case in federal court in Missoula challenging those practices. And our hope is that it really gets at this inequitable cash bail system that has been existed or that has existed in the United States for many years.
I hadn't heard of that case, and I can see that that's a, how should I say it, really, that is totally nonpartisan. I can't think of anybody who would look at that case and say, oh, that's something that the right wing will like or the left wing can hate. You know, that's something that everybody should be upset about.
Yeah, indeed. Nobody should have their front door busted in and a bunch of Keystone cops who aren't even law enforcement wearing body armor and carrying assault rifles threaten their six-year-old daughter.
Yeah, right. And I think it would be really shocking to a lot of people just to learn that there are bounty hunters that actually are out there in this day and age. It's it just boggles the mind.
Yeah, we all know about debt collectors, which are sometimes bad enough, but this sort of thing. And I, the reason I'm glad you brought that one up, because it illustrates that the ACLU does a lot of work on issues which are simply about being against human rights and being against normal behavior in a society. You know what I mean? Things that we shouldn't tolerate under any circumstances, regardless of your opinion or background or whatever. Why I'm saying that is because I know the ACLU gets a lot of criticism, because many of your cases are politically one side or another. But you do a lot of cases which are, every American should say, yeah, that really needs to be challenged.
Yeah, I mean, we're very interested in making sure that, again, that we're a voice and an instrument for marginalized communities. And I don't believe that, you know, somebody who's in jail is necessarily a Democrat or a Republican. So we don't view the work that we do as political. We view the work that we do as advocating for those people who need a voice.
Yep.
Very good.
Point taken. Alex, I appreciate the time. Obviously you're busy. Everybody is in their own way, even when you're working from home. And under the circumstances, I suspect your caseload is not going to go down.
I think that's a fair characterization. And for your listeners who are interested in more information, please do visit our website, aclumontana.org.
Yeah, I've been to the website several times, and it's quite a bit of information that people can look up there. Again, I think people would be surprised at the incredible range of cases that you've taken on in the last 2 years, and how many of them are still pending, for that matter. So,
Well, the gears of justice grind slowly.
So, again, thank you very much. I appreciate your time.
Yeah, I appreciate the opportunity. Good to talk to you all.
Okay. Bye for now.
Thank you.
All right. Take care.
We're back here at A Podcast Runs Through It. Having finished the interview with Alex Raitt from the Montana ACLU, Dixie, I think that was a pretty good run-through of some of their recent cases, but I think maybe you have this reaction too. I'm not sure. But, you know, he's a lawyer, and they are not taking sides per se on many of these issues. They are simply working through the legal issues, and I don't think he can bring to it the kind of, how shall we say,
outrage? I don't think that most people are aware of the fact that there's a federal response that's being planned to the Keystone XL pipeline against protesters that it requires batons and weaponizing the agencies that are going to be responding to it. I mean, I think most people would just be shocked and outraged at that.
Yeah, and the underlying assumption that all those protesters are terrorists.
Exactly. You know, and of course, then there's the bounty hunters that came into this individual's home in the middle of the night while he was sleeping with his family. But I don't think people are aware that things like that are happening.
No, and the ACLU does cases like this all the time. You know, they do tens of thousands of cases a year, maybe not a year, but they have done many, many cases every year, and a lot of them are quite outrageous.
Yeah, right. And, you know, and people, I just would really encourage people to go to their website. Then each state has a chapter, and ours is aclumontana.org. And just look at some of the work that they're doing. And I think, you know, they're always there. They're working in the background to protect the rights and civil liberties of people who are unable to do that for themselves, you know. And when their rights are being protected, all of our rights are being protected. It's, you know, they do excellent work.
Yeah, and have been doing that for a long time. And they take a lot of arrows. They take a lot of things in the back, and you know, because they are taking on controversial issues. That's what they do.
Right.
But I think their history, even, you know, across the ideological board, when you sit people down, and even politicians from one ideology or another, they say, well, the ACLU, we don't like them on this and this, but actually they do cases that help us too, you know.
Right,
that's
yes.
What they've been doing, you know.
Yeah, it's absolutely nonpartisan. It's sort of like, if you care about civil liberties and rights, then you should be a supporter of the ACLU. It's not one party or the other. It is basically, they are there to protect our civil liberties and our rights. And, you know, it is interesting listening to him talk about some of these cases, because, you know, it's his world. So, I, you know, of course, there isn't that outrage. But I think a lot of people would be really surprised to go to that website and look at their list of cases and how involved they are currently, right now, on a lot of different issues.
Yeah, it reminds me of a juggler. They keep all these cases up in the air. They're juggling all the time, you know.
Exactly.
Because a legal process, as everybody knows, is slow, usually, and frustrating, usually. But they do it. They do it for us, and they make their, you know, make a lot of impact. So again, thanks to Alex Reed for coming and talking with us, and I hope you enjoyed this interview from A Podcast Runs Through It. And stay home, stay safe.
Wash your hands.
And wash your hands.